All right, Josh, it is October 5th, 2017. Playoffs are officially well underway, but we still haven't seen the start of the NLDS either series. So what do you say we break that down and then take a week off before we have to do this again?
Let's get to it.
All right. We're going to do the Nats and the Cubs first, I figure. Who do you want to take, the Nats or the Cubs, in talking about how we got here?
I guess I'll take the local team. I'll take the Nationals and kind of start it off. Basically while everybody was talking about the Dodgers and the hot run that they went on to try and outpace themselves in the league, the Nationals were kind of sitting there lurking in the shadows pretty close to them for a majority of the season. They also started incredibly hot at the beginning of the year. And I think what makes it so amazing about the Nats finishing where they did today, I think with 97 wins, was the amount of injuries that they had to deal with along the way. I mean, they basically had key pieces fall down for large chunks of time during the season. And they were able to still go out there and just consistently put up W's night in and night out. So this is a team that, you know, offensively is pretty strong. we'll get into a little bit more of the specifics. A lot of it has to do with some of the people coming back from injuries. Bryce Harper being probably the big noticeable one, but I think the strength of this team has been the starting pitching. When you look at the big three that they're bringing up of Max Scherzer, Steven Strasburg, and Gio Gonzalez, I think those would be the three big guys to watch who got them here in the first place and are the keys for them getting to the promised land.
Right, and then that's the big story for their first half of the season was that they their bullpen was maybe the worst ever. So even with all these injuries, if they had had a competent offseason, they could have been even better.
Well, it's crazy because, I mean, they were going out there and trying to make the attempt to get a lot of these top-end relievers that were available on the market, and the guys just ended up signing somewhere else. A big one in this series is Wade Davis. Wade Davis was courted by the Nationals and was offered by the Nationals and decided to sign with the Cubs. So, at the beginning of the season, I mean, it was pretty tough to watch, and the Nationals had to make some pretty big moves to try and go get basically a whole new back end of the bullpen to shore it up so they could be ready for the time. So they could be ready by the time the playoffs rolled around.
Yeah, I remember the best R baseball post of the season was Nationals bullpen defy doubters who think they'll give up a 10-run lead, only give up 9 runs.
It's fun to go to the park and see people who have the classic, my bullpen makes me drink shirt.
So Wade Davis's new squad, the Chicago Cubs, turned out by a lot of advanced metrics to almost be the exact same team as the Nationals. They're very similar, as we'll discuss, in runs scored, WOBA, WRC+, XFIP. Basically across the board, they are identical in terms of advanced statistics outcomes. The Cubs, in the words of Dennis Green, at the end of the season, looking back, the Cubs are who we thought they were coming in. They are a very talented, very young bunch. What the story of the Cubs was for the first 90 games or so of this season is regression. The Cubs regressed at the start of this season at a lot of different positions. Chris Bryant is really the only one who continued to tear it up, so to speak, like they did last year. I mean, everybody knows at all of 2016, the Cubs were world beaters. In the playoffs, they were world beaters, and they ended up beating the world and becoming world champions. But this season, you had Kyle Schwarber play so badly, he actually got sent down to the minors.
Need a little vacay.
Addison Reed got arrested for domestic violence, and he regressed offensively. I don't think the two were connected, but I like to throw that out there because I don't like the Cubs.
All the facts. Just the facts.
Javier Baez did not play as well. Ian Happ looks like he could be a pretty good player, but he still hasn't quite figured it out yet. He was a call-up for them. He's playing center field. And Jason Hayward continues to have one of the worst contracts in baseball.
Which is tough because he's a likable dude, but he's been basically an albatross for that team. I mean,
I don't understand why he doesn't hit for power. He's so big and strong.
It's crazy, right? I mean, we all saw the videos too of him this offseason, like trying to retool his swing and do whatever. I mean, basically, we all like thought that he might be able to, like, you know, finally tap into that size and use his levers to swing, but he's just got such a long swing, and it's one of those things is people just start throwing harder and harder. And you have to start your swing earlier and earlier to be able to hit it. I mean, off speed becomes so much of a dagger against you that it might be that he never gets to become a consistent hitter while also trying to tap into his power.
Josh, what do you say we get into some breakdowns here? Lineups, starting pitchers, bullpen, and X factors. So lineups. We already said, statistically, these two teams are identical. The Cubs turned it on at the end of the year, and they ended up scoring 822 runs on the season. The Nats have 819. In terms of weighted on base average, the Cubs had a WOBA of 331. The Nats had a WOBA of 331. By WRC+, our favorite offensive statistic, Cubs had a WRC plus as a team of 101. The Nats had a WRC plus as a team of 100. I'm willing to call this a draw.
I'm looking at it. I'm sure if you're listening to this podcast, you've been on the internet. So you're familiar with the picture of the meme of two Spider-Mans pointing at each other. That's effectively what these two offenses are doing, basically, right? But I do think this is one situation where you kind of have to dig a little bit beyond the numbers and kind of try and give some context to figure out if there is an advantage for one squad over the other. I say that because, you know, we mentioned earlier that the Nationals had a bunch of injuries. I mean, they lost Adam Eaton, who was clearly a spark plug for them. Excuse my lame baseball reference, but clearly just a dude like creating offense at the top of that lineup. They lost Bryce Harper for about 6 weeks near the end of the season. The Cubs were fighting to basically get into the playoffs throughout the end of the season, having to stave off the Cardinals and the Brewers for the NL Central, while the Nationals had the luxury of playing in what was probably one of the worst divisions in baseball history. And so they're just, you know, there was a time to like give the September call-ups to come up and get some at-bats, let people get a lot of rest in, and just kind of prepare themselves. So I think with that context, if you really had to give an advantage to one of these lineups right now, I would probably go with the Nationals. But I don't think it's a very big advantage. And I think by the time you kind of get to the end of the season and everyone's ready to go, it could tilt either way by the end of five games.
See, I'd go in the other direction if forced to give an advantage. I think the Nats have better players overall in Anthony Rendon and Bryce Harper, but Harper spent a ton of time on the DL, and the Nationals have kind of sputtered here and there offensively. The Cubs have guys who have been there before, and like I said, they have regressed, but I'm a big fan of playoff experience, and guys like Kyle Schwarber and Chris Bryant and Javier Baez got big hits last year, and I think they'll be able to do it again. And Anthony Rizzo, I didn't even mention him in my first spiel on the Cubs.
Yeah, I mean, we saw the Cubs basically able to, you know, not crumble under the pressure of trying to break the curse last year. Whereas, like, while it's not nearly as famous, I mean, everyone in Washington knows that, you know, we really would like to see the Nationals kind of get out of the first round of the playoffs, you know, win a series and at least make it seem like they're competitive in October. So that could be a factor. I don't know if it's something that really bothers the players that much, but I think from a fan base stand, you can kind of feel more of a tension on one side than on the other.
Yeah, I agree. Like, the Cubs kind of have the monkey off their back, so to speak, and the Nats, well, the big story of Washington sports across all sports is that they don't win when it counts.
Yep, sadly.
So you're going to go with the Nats and the Cubs. I'm going to call it a draw. I don't think either team has a clear-cut advantage here. But you're going to go with the Nats. Starting pitching is where I think this really gets interesting.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's a favorable matchup for Washington, but that's really contingent on the idea that Max Scherzer's healthy. Of course, you know, as we all know, he injured his hammy. There was no structural damage. He's expected to pitch in the series. But, you know, at the same time, if he's still feeling it, you know, 80% or 90% Max Scherzer is still pretty good, but not as good as 100% Scherzer. It's if you told me that those guys are at full strength of having Scherzer, Strasburg, and Gio, I would take that top three against the Cubs as the advantage. But if there's an injury there, it's a sharp drop off afterwards, because then you're looking at Tanner Roark or an AJ Cole or an Edwin Jackson, and all three of those guys were just not that effective for most of the year, and especially not towards the end of the season. So it's a contingency, but I would say the Nationals have the advantage in terms of starting pitching.
Exactly. The Nationals, and this is another situation where on the surface, the Nats and the Cubs look very similar. So first, I'm going to give a quick primer on the statistic I'm going to use to break this down, which is XFIP, which is expected fielding independent pitching. Basically, it's fielding independent pitching, which measures a pitcher's direct impact on the game, but with home runs stabilized for a league average rate, because that home run rates tend to fluctuate from pitcher to pitcher and even season to season by pitcher. So if you assume a league average home run rate, then you really see kind of a pitcher's direct abilities impact in the game. And when you look at XFIP, the Nats do have a bit of an advantage across the board, even with their poor performance at the back end of their rotation. 4.98 as a team to the Cubs 4.10. But where they really have a clear advantage is the Nats have three of the top 20 starters by XFIP in the league, which is Max Scherzer, Steven Strasburg, and Gio Gonzalez, putting up a 3.28, 3.27, and 4.24 XFIP in order. One thing to watch out for, though, with Gio Gonzalez, his expected fielding independent pitching is 4.24. His actual fielding independent pitching was around a 3.3, and his ERA was a 2.96, which indicates to me, at least, that he got pretty lucky across the season.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, because if we all think back to the beginning of the season when the Cubs were struggling, it wasn't the offense that was necessarily causing them issues. It was the starting pitching. The starting pitching was probably the position group where they regressed the most. And, you know, a lot of it was John Lester, John Lackey, and Jake Arrieta were just not the same people that they were the previous season. Now, they've been able to turn it on recently, and they were able to go out.
And they picked up Jose Quintana.
Picked up Jose Quintana, who was able to go just right across town and join a winning team, probably enjoys his life now. So it's one where – I'm sorry, the White Sox have just been atrocious recently.
Dude, but I've been going to the White Sox games. They've been worse than atrocious.
Yeah, it's been they but man, they made some moves, dude. The farm system they have now is unreal.
I'm really excited to keep going to White Sox games next season.
But in terms of the Cubs, I mean, I think you look at in terms of ceilings, the Nationals have three pitchers whose ceilings are exciting and probably could give you a, you know, 8-inning shutout performance. Whereas when you look at track record, it definitely does fall in the favor of the Cubs. And even though they've had down collectively as a unit, they've had a down year this year. There's still some talent there. I mean, I think he's still, you know, trying to face cross-firing Jake Arrieta. He's probably uncomfortable if you're a right-handed hitter. Jose Quintana has just been subtly excellent for the past like 7 to 8 years now. And, you know, John Lester and John Lackey are just two guys. I mean, they've been in the playoffs a bunch. It sounds silly to say, but, like, they're kind of old enough to know how to, like, handle the situations, not worry. I think, you know, we saw all the talent in the world with Luis Severino, but he got into a situation where he got into his own head and couldn't make it out of the first inning. So while it can be overblown, I don't think adding it to your team is the best thing in the world. It does help to have some experience, and the Cubs definitely have that.
So even though the Cubs do have experience, especially with John Lester, who has kind of built his name on being an elite playoff pitcher, I think we're both going to go with the Nats having the advantage among starting pitching, right? Or at least as long as Scherzer's healthy.
Yep, I would say as long as Scherzer is able to at least pitch, I would lean towards the Nationals having the advantage at the top of the rotation.
So let's move on to bullpens. This is where I think the Cubs definitely have an advantage, because while the Nats, like we mentioned, had an all-time bad bullpen at the beginning of the year, they did make significant improvements. Picked up Sean Doolittle and Ryan Madsen from the Oakland Athletics. They picked up Brandon Kinsler from the Twins. They have really managed to steady the ship, so to speak, in the second half of this season since the trade deadline. But beyond that, those three guys, really all they got.
Yeah, and I mean, it stands in pretty stark contrast with what the Cubs are able to throw out there. I mean, the Cubs have Wade Davis sitting at the end of the bullpen ready to come in for saves. But we know Joe Maddon's a pretty forward-thinking guy. It's very likely we could see him kind of in 4- and 5-out situations to kind of help shut down a game. But, I mean, they also made pickup to go get Justin Wilson and then add that to Carl Edwards Jr., Pedro Strop, Mike Montgomery. I think the Cubs have a pretty solid advantage here just in terms of the depth and the number of arms that they can bring in. We were mentioning earlier, like, you know, if you're the Nationals, you're really, really, really depending on your starters being able to get to the, you know, through six innings so that the 7th, 8th, and 9th can go to the guys that you trust, because anyone besides those three that you mentioned that they picked up and Matt Albers has been the equivalent of a dumpster fire for at least part of, if not the entire season. So the Cubs kind of get to breathe easy and know that, you know, hey, look, in case the starter's running out of trouble, we have capable arms sitting there ready to go.
Yeah, and the Cubs bullpen, the big thing they've got going on is depth. They don't have anybody who's particularly elite up at the top, and statistically they were close together in terms of WAR, at least. But the Cubs have good pitchers at least 4 deep with Wade Davis, Pedro Strop, Carl Edwards Jr., and Brian Dunsing. They also throw in Hector Rondon and Koji Uehara and Justin Wilson just for good measure, although none of those guys pitched particularly dominantly across the season.
No, but I mean, the thing is, like, as we saw, you know, with the Royals and then last year with the Indians and even with the Cubs last year, just kind of having a bunch of arms that you can kind of go to and use whenever you need just allows you a lot more flexibility. I mean, we saw extreme versions of it in the wild card series because it was a 1-game playoff, but even in these 5- and 7-game series, it's really, really huge that you can win a game. And so it's really, really huge that you know that you have kind of a safety net to be able to throw out there whenever you need to, instead of kind of like sitting there and just hoping and praying that you can gap the bridge and make it to your sure-armed guy at the back of the bullpen.
So I'm going with the Cubs as well. What do you feel about X factors, Josh? I've got a good one for the Nats if you want to hear it.
Please do.
The Cubs' total inability to throw runners out at second, and the Nats having Trey Turner batting leadoff.
Yeah, I think it's a pretty good option, actually. We all know about Lester's struggles. We all know about Arrieta's struggles, and just kind of that entire staff as a whole to be able to kind of hold runners. And putting their catchers into pretty bad positions to the point where one of them had to complain about how difficult it was and ended up getting axed off the team. But, yeah, I mean, the fact that the Nationals have a couple burners and then a supreme burner like a Trey Turner available in the lineup, being able to create some serious havoc on the base path might be something that can help tilt the advantage back in their favor.
For the Cubs, I'd say their X factor is probably just starting pitching in general.
Yep. I mean, it's what they rode to the championship last year. I mean, obviously they had great bats and whatever, but as we saw, like, you know, the bats are one part of the equation. When the pitching went away this year, they struggled, they floundered. And when it started to pick up at the end of the season, guess what? Look, they were a resurgent team and able to push their way back into the playoffs. So it's a wide X factor, but it's definitely one that's easy to see that if the starting pitching for the Cubs don't perform, it's very hard for them to be able to dig themselves out of that hole.
Let's move on to the other series. The game happened in that night. What do you say?
Yeah, let's do it. I think this is going to be a really interesting one because looking at it once again, like the wild card series, you have a couple division rivals. And what's very interesting about this is that both teams managed to sweep each other during the season. With the Dodgers doing it early on when they were kind of in the midst of their like 51-4 win streak or whatever they were going on at the time. And then the Diamondbacks twice when the Dodgers were out there losing like 15 out of 18 and 19 out of 20 games. So it's one of those where the Diamondbacks have the season series advantage, but it was almost like these games were kind of like played in a bizarro environment where a team was either above the water or sinking or drowning. So it's kind of hard to get a gauge of where they're at right now and how they would match up together.
Yeah, we were talking about this. Both these teams are pretty evenly matched across the board. They get to the end game, a win in vastly different ways, but statistically, they're pretty equivalent in a lot of ways, especially in the second half of the season.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about lineup. I know you like the Dodgers' depth.
Yeah, this is an interesting one because, I mean, when you look at the Dodgers as a team and you kind of, you know, say, well, where are their superstars at? I mean, a lot of the names that come to mind, Clayton Kershaw, Yu Darvish, Kenley Jansen, those are all guys that are on the pitching side of it. When you look on the hitting side of it, it's Justin Turner. And while they have a lot of good young guys, you know, Rookie of the Year, Corey Seager, most likely Rookie of the Year this year, and Cody Bellinger, it's really not one where there's a huge disparity between the guys at the top of the order and guys at the bottom of the order. You have players like Chris Taylor and, to a lesser extent, Kike Hernandez, who have been able to come on and really help the team out just by kind of playing multiple positions, being flexible, being able to bat anywhere in the order. And so you have a team where, like, there's no real holes in the lineup. And you can contrast that with the Diamondbacks, where you kind of have your big bats sitting in the middle. And the rest of the lineup is capable, but you kind of have an idea of, like, you know exactly who you should be fearing in J.D. Martinez and Paul Goldschmidt and Jake Lamb.
Yeah, I was about to dive right in on the Diamondbacks. They've really been carried in the second half of the year by having picked up J.D. Martinez. Paul Goldschmidt kind of floundered in September, but he's still Paul Goldschmidt. We all saw the three-run homer he hit on John Gray in the first inning. Really just took him to task. Jake Lamb has become one of the best third basemen in baseball quietly in a league deep at the position with superstars. He really doesn't get talked about that much, but he can hang right there with anybody in the game, really.
Yep.
And they've got talent at almost every position, but they have some of those guys are pretty inconsistent. But where you really look is those 3, 4, 5 spots for the Diamondbacks and how many runs they can produce against the Dodgers.
I mean, the holes that the Diamondbacks have, I would say, kind of at the catcher position, the second base position, and then Kettle Marte is he's a pretty good player, but I mean, I don't think you necessarily fear him offensively. Those are just kind of weak points that I think if you have a strong enough pitching staff like the Dodgers do, there's opportunity there to get outs and kind of pitch yourself out of situations and not having to worry about facing Goldschmidt, Lamb, and Martinez.
Well, that's an interesting point because we both mention that both these teams have really great depth at starting pitcher. But the real difference maker is going to be, is Clayton Kershaw going to go back to being Clayton Kershaw for this series? He hasn't pitched as traditional Clayton Kershaw in the past. He wasn't as dominant because of injuries this year as he has been in the past few years. Is he going to be able to turn in really game-controlling starts like we know he's capable of?
He's such a great talent, and he's so good at pitching that it's silly to sit here and say, oh, man, he's really struggling in the playoffs. Like, I don't think he can do it. Like, of course he can do it. Like, I definitely would sit there and believe it. What's interesting to look at with Clayton Kershaw is the way he struggled. This is a dude who, you know, doesn't really have a very strong time through the order penalty, but for whatever reason in his playoff starts, he has a horrific ERA of 25.20 in the seventh inning. And for whatever reason, it's just kind of one of those, he can go out there and get you six good innings. And some of his starts have been mired by the fact that he didn't get run support when he could have used it. But it's kind of just one of those, like, hey, look, he can go out there and get us a good start, or maybe even what will qualify as a quality start. But can he kind of be the ace that we know can shut down the other team and hold them down long enough for us to get runs? And that's just what we haven't actually seen from him in the playoffs yet.
And the ace for the Diamondbacks, they probably won't be matched up at all in this series because he just went in the wild card game, Zach Greinke. He's never exactly been dominant in the playoffs either. And we just saw him get bounced in the fourth inning against, albeit a very good hitting Rockies team.
To be fair, though, like, who has made it past the fourth inning as a starting pitcher?
Justin Verlander. It only took him 80 pitches.
Yeah, exactly, right? Like, it's one of those where, you know, hitters are just getting better. And, of course, now you're in the playoffs. You're facing the best hitters in the league. A lot of teams have kind of worked to try and get healthy at this point of the season. So you're watching people who have, you know, had some rest go up there and be able to kind of, their reflexes are sharp. They're able to kind of catch up with some of the velocity that they're facing. So, I mean, it is kind of understandable. And plus, it's high stakes. You know, managers are now more in a position where they have a much quicker, much shorter leash than they would in the middle of June, right? So it's kind of one of those things where I don't think we're going to see too many 8-inning, 78-pitch just gems being twirled out there. The hitters are just too good. But I think at the same time, like, you do expect to see a little bit more out of somebody of a Greinke level or out of a Clayton Kershaw level. And I think if either team can get that from their starting pitching, then you would expect them to have the advantage in the series.
But this starting pitching doesn't just come down to the aces. Both these starting pitching staffs have great depth. The Dodgers went out and picked up Yu Darvish at the deadline. He's been pretty good for them.
It's pretty good depth, huh?
And they have probably my favorite pitcher in baseball, not named Big Sexy, Rich Hill. Rich Hill is your classic spinner of a lefty. He throws majority breaking balls. And late in his career, he's figured out how to leverage his stuff into being an, at times, dominant pitcher.
Right. I mean, we all saw him take the perfect game into the ninth inning, and we saw that collapse. But we all saw the fact that, like, for a dude who's, you know, not throwing upper 90s and is having to literally sit on trickeration, he has the ability to make great pitches and be able to keep hitters off balance all night and make them uncomfortable. I definitely think if you're looking at a straight one-to-one matchup, I think if everyone is pitching at the top of their, you know, talent spectrum, the Dodgers have an advantage, because having a 1-2 punch of Clayton Kershaw and Yu Darvish, and then having the capability of a Rich Hill, or even though he's been struggling recently, even having somebody like an Alex Wood, who has shown at the beginning of the season that he can go out there and match it up with the best of them, there's just a lot of arms that they can go through and kind of feel comfortable saying, like, hey, look, like, this guy should get us a great chance to win.
And on the other team, the Diamondbacks will come at the Dodgers with two guys who have been very good this year, in Robbie Ray and Zach and Zach Godley. Robbie Ray in particular has had himself one hell of a season. Another lefty, not as much of a breaking ball guy as Rich Hill is, but he's a pretty good pitcher in his own right.
Yeah, I mean, he's definitely not a Rich Hill. He's got a little bit of power from that left side. He can blow it by you if he needs to. Likes to go with the fastball up. But it's one of those things where Zach Godley and Robbie Ray and even Archie Bradley, who I know has been in their bullpen, and we'll get to that in a second, but, I mean, they have a lot of guys who are capable of going out there and giving them just six or seven just shutdown innings. And that was something that the Diamondbacks just hadn't had in recent history.
You mentioned bullpens. Josh, we might as well get to it. This is where the Dodgers seem to have an advantage.
Yeah, that advantage is called Kenley Jansen.
Well, they also have a lot of depth, but let's start with Kenley Jansen. Is he the best reliever in baseball this year, or do you think that goes to one of the guys in the NL East? Or not in the NL East, in the AL East, excuse me.
In the AL East. No, I got you. Don't worry. It's tough because Craig Kimbrell was – I mean, he was classic vintage Craig Kimbrell. I mean, he was a kicker we saw down in Atlanta that, you know, just struggled for a couple of years, and I guess we all gave up on him. But, I mean, he was disgusting this year. The problem is Kenley Jansen is basically like Mariano 2.0, except he throws even harder. I mean, he's just this big dude who has a cutter, can control the cutter, can kind of make the cutter move however he wants. And then no matter the fact that you know what's coming, he just is apparently impossible to hit. I mean, the times he does get himself in trouble, it's just because he's throwing too hard and he's giving up walks. So if I had to choose and lean one direction, it would be the former catcher who turned into pitching god, Kenley Jansen. But, you know, like I said, there's definitely other good arms at the back end of the bullpen, but this guy's right near the top.
One thing that cued on the bullpens for me when I was looking at the numbers, Joshua, was strikeout-to-walk ratio. The Dodgers have a very respectable bullpen team-wide strikeout-to-walk ratio of 3.48. That's everybody who's pitching their bullpen all year. Less respectable is the Diamondbacks' 2.61.
Yeah, the nice thing is, like, with these guys being in the same division, they were basically playing against each other, facing the same opponents, and you could see that the bullpen unit for the Dodgers was just, by and large, the better unit. The Dodgers also made a couple smart moves to go pick up useful lefties like a Tony Watson and a Tony Cingrani to add to that bullpen. And so they have a ton of different arms, different angles that can hit you, and they've been successful all year because they have the depth to be able to survive like a Pedro Baez blow-up, which they were dealing with at the end of the season there. So I think their definite strength is the fact that, you know, they don't have to worry about the bridge to Kenley Jansen nearly as much as, like, other teams have to worry about the bridge to their closers.
So one thing, we're not going to do X factors per se in this pod, but we do have to talk about, we mentioned it before, the Diamondbacks' regular season dominance over the Dodgers.
Yeah, like we said, I mean, the Dodgers sweep the early – Dodgers swept, excuse me, the early season series. But the last six games, the Diamondbacks won all of them, and they scored a ton of runs on the Dodgers. I mean, they basically just looked like the better team. And for the most part, the Dodgers, you know, should have been able to put that division away given the unreal hot streak they were on during the middle of the summer. But the Diamondbacks were able to sit there and basically kind of keep pace and, you know, at least stay within, I think it was, where'd they finish? About 11 games back at one point. I know it was in the 20s. So, you know, they were able to kind of sit there and close the gap a little bit and go toe-to-toe with the Dodgers.
It's an interesting matchup when you have the wild card team who in the second half of the season kind of owned the favorite, basically the league-wide favorite to win the World Series.
So right.
It'll be curious to see if that can hold up across the rest of across this divisional series. So it's time for picks, Josh. Who are we going to see in the NLCS?
Not just yet. There's one more X factor we always got to mention, and that is the living X factor himself.
How could I forget Yasiel Puig?
Yasiel Puig, the wild horse, like the literal definition of an X factor. I mean, here's a guy who has just all the talent in the world, you know, just kind of puts it together in spurts and short bursts and whatever. And you're wondering, hey, can he do it for a 5-game, 7-game series at some point in the playoffs? So, I mean, anybody who's watched him over the last couple of years knew that he was going to be the X-Factor choice here.
So, Josh, let's start predictions this way. What's going to be our Puigiest Yasiel Puig moment of this series? I bet I'm going to give you Puigiest Yasiel Puig moment will be a bat flip on a ground rule double.
I have
Robbie Ray.
Oh, Robbie Ray. I have my Puigiest just like X Factor moment being him coming in to catch a routine fly ball, it bouncing off the heel of his glove, and him having a cannon enough to still throw the guy out at third trying to advance on it. Like, just absolutely snatching defeat from the jaws of victory and yet still coming away with victory.
That sounds pretty Puiggy. So who are we going to see in the NLCS, Josh?
It's pretty interesting. I think both of these, you know, I mean, basically we talked all year long about how the NL was basically top heavy and then the AL had a ton of parity. But when you look at the matchups, it's much easier to see who's going to win over on the American League side, whereas we've got two pretty closely contested series over here. So it's tough for me to say, I think, and it's almost more of a gut reaction for some of this, but I think we're going to see the Nationals finally pull through and be able to win a division series and eliminate the Cubs solely because the Cubs owner decided to try and mock them as a franchise in his meeting at the White House celebrating the last championship. So let's hope that lights a fire under somebody besides just me, a jaded fan who's tired of seeing other teams win. And then I think on what's effectively the Western playoff side, I think we're going to see the Dodgers pull through. I think they literally just have too much talent over there. I know that the Diamondbacks have played them well, as we mentioned, but for the most part, I mean, they went on a cold streak where it was just kind of like, okay, sequencing kind of got to them. All the numbers came back and started to even itself out. So, you know, this wasn't a team that was going to win 125 games in a season, but they still did win 104, and they still did finish 11 games above the Diamondbacks. I think they're just the better team.
So I'm going to agree with you on the first pick. I think the Nationals are going to pull it out. I believe in Max Scherzer's knee. I'm not a big believer in the Cubs this year. I think that regression stays with them. I'm going to go the other direction, and I'm going to say it's going to be the Diamondbacks they're facing in the NLCS. I think the late season dominance was for real. I think the Diamondbacks are going to pull it out. I think Zach Greinke's start was nothing to be too worried about.
Nah.
I think Robbie Ray is going to pitch well. I think Zach Godley is going to pitch well. And I wouldn't be surprised to see Patrick Corbin turn in a pretty significant start.
I mean, I also think Archie Bradley is going to put up an OPS of about 950 this series. So
only 950? It's OPS, Josh.
Oh, 1950. No, I mean, it's funny to say. I think if you're either a Nats or a Cubs fan, you're looking at that one series and you're going, we're playing the Dodgers? Ah, damn it. Or we're playing the Diamondbacks? Ah, damn it. I mean, there's just really no kind of cut or clear favorite in that one. It's really interesting to see how it shakes out.
Yeah, there's a solid argument to be made that the Diamondbacks are, at least on paper, the third best team left in this playoffs. Behind the Indians, Dodgers. I'm not sure I would buy that argument, even if I were saying it, but
ESPN went the other way and gave them the worst odds to win the World Series.
ESPN's just a hater.
Come on, dude. They're the worldwide leader in sports. They know what they're talking about. They love baseball.
Baseball and hockey. ESPN specialties. All right, Josh. It is almost 12:30. On the East Coast.
I can't sleep. I'm so excited for these games now.
Well, you're going to have to stay up all night.
No, that's a lie. I can sleep. Don't worry.
All right, buddy. It's good talking to you. I'll see you once these series ends to talk about the championship series and figure out where we went wrong on this one. which will be nowhere, right?
Oh, of course, no. I mean, we know baseball, obviously.
See you, buddy.